welcome to another episode of Carb Malarkey. Today we have our first ever returning guest, and we will be speaking to the lovely Jesse Alexander about his new documentary series. Enjoy.
How are you?
I can't complain. Other than you know, plagues and possible wars in Europe, and I don't know whatever else is going to destroy the entire world. But otherwise, I'm not doing too bad.
Yeah, that sounds like we've just completely stepped back in time, doesn't it? Plague.
Yeah.
I mean, what else could go on now?
I wish.
It's a hard plan for a history podcast, isn't it? It's like the world is bleak. Let's produce a history podcast.
Right. What are you going to do?
Yeah, exactly. You can't change it. You just got to live with it.
We'll get through it.
Well, thank you for coming back on, Jesse, because it's lovely to have you. And
my pleasure.
It's so interesting every time you come on. Well, your second time now. I think you're our first returning guest, which
you are actually.
That's exciting.
Yeah,
I'll take that as a sign I didn't fuck it all up too bad last time.
Oh. No, not at all. But you might do this time, so who knows? There's always a third time lucky, isn't there? Right, should we dive in? Are you ready to go?
I had one question beforehand, which was I wanted to mention an anecdote in response to one of your questions.
Yeah.
And in this anecdote, the French marshal swears.
Oh, that's fine.
That's fine.
You cool with a couple of F-bombs from the Frenchman?
I mean, our name's Malarkey.
Yeah.
So our American audience are already.
I ain't going to cast aspersions. So, you know.
Yeah. No, I like that you asked. Bless you. Thank you.
I've definitely been guilty of dropping the odd F-bomb in the show. So don't worry at all.
All right. Okay. Then, let's do it.
Let's go. Okay, Jesse, so this is round two. You kind of know what to expect from us, and we're here to talk about your new documentary series. So can you please summarise for us what it is in 30 seconds?
Yes, it's a new series produced by Real Time History. It's going to be launched on YouTube at the end of February. It's called Napoleon's Downfall, and the first season is about Napoleon's invasion of Russia in 1812. He decides to invade Russia to impose his will on the entire continent and eventually defeat Britain in so doing, but things don't go as planned, and his massive army, the biggest ever seen in Europe up until that time, ends up being destroyed over the course of this campaign, and it becomes, in retrospect, sort of the first step in his eventual downfall in 1815.
Nice.
Sounds good. So this series, from what I gather, is going to be focusing more on the officers and the men involved rather than the kind of the big characters in it, the big boys, Napoleon, Alexander. So how was your research process in terms of unearthing these stories? How did you go about finding all these, I'm sure, fascinating stories of men's experiences in war?
Yes, also women, as we're going to see.
And women as well.
There's a few very interesting stories of women outside of the usual sphere at the time. But anyway, the good thing is, as a public historian, I can do like, what's that famous quote? Was it Isaac Newton? I'm just standing on the shoulders of giants or whatever. There's been a lot of great work done already. So I do dip in a little bit to like published memoirs and diaries and things, but there's so much that's already been worked on by historians that basically I can dip into that literature and pick and choose the interesting characters or the kind of most revealing passages from the stories of the rank and file when we have them, which is more rare at this time. There are even some Russian peasant soldiers who later learned to write and wrote down some of their experiences, a few of them, not many, more on the European/French side. So that's kind of what we're doing. And thankfully, because this campaign involves not just Russia and France, but other parts of Europe as well, it means there's literature available in different languages, and I'm lucky enough that I can read in French and German, so I'll be able to go and check out what's been published in those languages to kind of go and get some extra nuggets for the audience that they might not have already heard or read. And we're working with a partner in Moscow, Sophia, who's a great public historian there, and she's kind of supplementing with some extra Russian content from the Russian literature. So together, we hope that we can kind of put, I mean, Napoleon's a classic. It's a lot of Napoleon in public history. Epic History TV's done great series on YouTube as well about Napoleonic era. But we hope to kind of put our spin on it.
Mm. What's been your favourite sources to work with? I mean, I'm a big fan of using memoirs. I think they can be, but I love the personal element to it. So what's been your favourite sources to work with?
Well, I mean, secondary wise, there's a French historian. Her name is Marie-Pierre Rey, and she is kind of a Russianist, but obviously being French, you know, she can master both sides of the deal. And she published a few years ago a single volume narrative of the 1812 campaign that focuses on the experiences of not the emperors and not the marshals and not the top generals and stuff. So that's kind of my, I would say perhaps my number one go-to. It's called L'effroyable tragédie, the terrible tragedy. But there's been some good work by a descendant of a Russian officer, a British historian, Dominic Levin, I think his name is. He's published some good stuff. And then there's a recent popular history by a Polish-American, Zamoyski is his name. And he's kind of in the style of, a little bit, he reminds me of Anthony Beaver for the World War II stuff, right?
Okay, cool.
So he's kind of very literary. Sometimes it's a little bit flowery in his language, but it's a very rich telling of the story. And so, you know, those are kind of my immediate go-tos, plus some specialized stuff. Like we had to dip into, this is kind of also a bit fun, we had to dip into some older stuff for some of the more obscure parts of the campaign, which ended up in us having to read the older German typescript that they used before the 1930s, which is like a different alphabet.
Yeah.
So, and also of course the Russians used a different alphabet back then than they use now. So we've been poring over some maps because of course the graphic element is really important for a documentary, right? We're like working on custom maps with a team of Canadians. So I think we're, we Canadians are kind of taking over the production now.
Nice.
But with a team of Canadians and we are using an old Russian map that's been digitized and they use the old freaking letters from before the current Russian letters. So yeah, we have fun with that kind of.
That's so cool.
Our brains boil, as they say.
I'm very jealous of your linguistic. I wish I'd learned a language because that's one thing I regret being, now I'm a historian, I've done uni. I wish I'd stuck to my mum's advice and actually stuck with a language and learned it because it does open up a whole new world in terms of sources.
It's never too late.
It's good. Never too late. I need to do that. What's the what's the online one you can do?
Do it. I mean, I do it. Yeah. Je parle plus français.
Only if you do it.
There you go.
Motivation. I need to be held accountable, Liv. If you do it with me, we'll learn a language.
I do every day. Every day I do my French lesson, Phoebe.
Well, there
every
day. There you go.
Le apprendez le français, Phoebe.
So so I can give the rest of this interview in French and we'll be good, right?
And I'll sit there and panic.
No, merci, no.
But look, take heart, folks, because look, I'm not some kind of genius and I was able to become fluent in German in my 30s.
Yeah.
And so I'm not great in Russian. I'm not fluent in Russian, but like, you know, I can kind of figure stuff out in a pinch with a bit more time. And I also did that in my 30s. So like you guys have loads of time since I'm presuming that you haven't reached your 30s yet. So you're good.
Well, Jesse,
when
you come back on for your third time, you'll have to hold me accountable for my language. Phoebe, have you learned the language yet?
We'll do. We'll do.
Give me a bollocking.
Just if I ask quickly before we go into the next our next question, what is the style of this? Like, so how are you bringing this history to life? Is it, have you got like animation? Are you archiving it? Like, because it's quite a difficult period of time to actually bring to life. You're not going to do, are you doing like a standard sit down, you know, archive interview, or how are you doing it?
Well, we're going to build on the sort of style that we feel has been successful for us and has worked for us so far. So essentially, like the visuals of it are going to be a mixture. It's going to be hosted by me in studio in front of a green screen, but with a digital background when I'm on screen, which is not that often, as little as possible. In fact, that's the objective for aesthetic and other reasons. But so we're going to have custom maps and those maps will be animated. So we'll have units moving and arrows moving and little highlights of where the river is that I'm talking about or whatever. We are going to have some custom made sketches, like illustrations done by a couple of artists in the US and in Germany. We work with a few really talented artists. We worked with them as well for the Franco-Prussian War series that is just finishing up this week on the Real Time History YouTube channel. And there's a treasure trove of period illustrations. So especially the Grande Armée, so Napoleon's European army, they had a whole host of artists with them who sketched stuff, who painted stuff. And much of that is copyright free. Or it's in these kind of commercial databases of images that we have bought subscriptions to because, you know, that's how capitalism works, et cetera, et cetera. So there's quite a lot that are copyright free that were, especially in the ones that have been digitized in US holdings, like Brown University in the US has a great series.
Library of Congress, all that stuff.
Exactly. Yeah. And because this campaign was so significant and so dramatic, and politically significant later, there are a lot of paintings. Now, those paintings are done after the fact, and they're sort of stylized, and they have their own messaging and symbolism, and they're not, you know, accurate, but they're representative. And so we're gonna combine all those things and hope that we can bring this kind of pre-photography period to life, because this is the first project we've done that is before the era of photographs.
Right, okay.
How do you find the working with art history? Because it can be, like you said, it's so representative. What, how did you find working with the paintings? It must have been so cool, some of them.
It is cool. It comes with its own challenges because, you know, as an interpreter of history in this case, you don't want to just use them at face value because they're not an accurate record of the battle that they depict. They depict what the people who paid the artist to paint them want later on, right? So there's a political message. So do you just slap them up when you're talking about that person or that battle and let it be? Or do you interrupt the kind of narrative and flow of events and dive into like a mini analysis of that particular painting, which can be great and can be interesting, but doesn't always fit, and it doesn't fit if you do it every time in terms of the viewer experience, right? For following along, for being also entertained as they're learning. You don't want to sit them into an art history, you know, political theory lecture. So we've got to kind of keep that balance between using those images to illustrate with, you know, the compromises that that entails, and then also taking some time once in a while to focus and analyze them. That's what we did for the Franco-Prussian War series, and we felt that that kind of worked all right. Oh, I should add, I forgot to mention, we're going to cover the 1812 series over the course of about 17 or 18 episodes.
Oh, wow, that's insane. Nice.
That's
huge. That is really going to be big. Okay, so going back to the content kind of itself, like, so you kind of mentioned to us that obviously we're looking at Napoleon's army at the time. And one thing I found really interesting in what you said is the fact that it didn't consist primarily of French soldiers and that actually half of it came from other European states. So why was that? Like, how did this happen? Was it something I'm not really familiar with?
This is such a big debate. Sorry to bring up the hellscape that is Twitter, but this is such a big debate on Twitter about Napoleon's army, about the French Empire, and it's a similar sort of thing that gets brought up in the World War II context of Britain alone, but where did the soldiers come from? Seems like people are now going back and looking at other armies, and it's particularly Napoleon's army that was just incredibly international, and it is fascinating to watch the dialogue unfold.
For sure, yeah, and this is a key aspect of what recent historical literature has focused on, and therefore what we also want to focus on. The Grande Armée that Napoleon sends into Russia, it's massive. It's like over 600,000 men, between sort of 600 and 670,000, depending on, you know, accuracy of the rolls and blah, blah, blah. And only about half come from France, within France's borders of 1812, which is a lot bigger than France today, right? So even within France itself, they've absorbed the Low Countries, they've absorbed a part of Western Germany, and they've absorbed part of Northern Italy. Mm-hmm. So right there, you have some diversity. In addition, you know, France dominates all of Europe at the time, except for Russia and little bits of Spain and Portugal, with some British help, but I'm not going to give you guys too much credit here. There's enough of that on Twitter. But so France creates a system of satellite and allied states that is basically everybody except Russia. And well, in this case, also for a few years, Sweden. So long story short, you have all these satellite countries like the Kingdom of Bavaria, the Kingdom of Westphalia, all these little dukedoms and things in what is now Germany. So they provide troops because their kings are Napoleon's marshals and brothers and stuff. So, you know, they are going to provide troops. Then you have the Kingdom of Italy, Kingdom of Naples, the Duchy of Warsaw. These are all ruled by French-friendly leaders. And so they all provide contingents to the Grande Armée as well. Spain does, also Portugal even, Denmark, for heaven's sake. And then you have the unhappy allies that Napoleon has whipped in previous years, namely Prussia and Austria. And he then forces them into an alliance and forces them to provide a corps each to send into Russia to guard the flanks. Although, of course, if their leaders had the freedom to choose, they wouldn't have been sending tens of thousands of men to invade Russia. They would have been trying to free themselves from Napoleon's domination. So that is how Napoleon's army ends up being half not French, and why it gets the nickname the Army of 20 Nations.
Was there really 20 involved?
27.
27. Wow. Can you list them off?
Jeez, you people are
30 seconds.
Cruel taskmasters here.
No, that's so cool. Like, and that's a part of history I feel like they don't, I think, gets kind of put aside. You know, it's not really focused in on the fact that you would pick on some of the bigger countries, as you mentioned, but you wouldn't really be taught about the depth of who was involved in that. It's really good that you guys are wanting to encapsulate that within the series.
And it really does change opinions on kind of, I know we're going to talk about nationalism a bit later, so I'll just touch upon it, but because militarism is so heavily linked to nationalism and you think the Grand Army is French, but it's not, and it really, I love all this international history we've got coming out lately, like you said, we can piece it all together, and it's then makes it more confusing as to why nationalism has come up so violently, I guess that's the best word, in some spaces. But like I said, we'll get onto that later. But before we do you want to talk about some of the, without giving too much away, obviously, no spoilers in the documentary, but do you want to talk about some of the campaigns that either you particularly enjoyed researching or you think are interesting for one reason or another?
Yeah, I mean, I think the reductionist view of this 1812 campaign in Russia is that Napoleon marches in, there's a big battle at, in English we usually call it Borodino, although it's Baradino, and the French call it La Moscova, but there's a big battle there, then Napoleon goes to Russia, and then he freezes, and all the Frenchmen freeze, and they walk all the way back, freezing as they go, and it's over. But it is so much more compelling and dramatic, and there are different times where it could have gone another way. So yes, we're going to cover Baradino, the biggest battle, one of the biggest of the Napoleonic era, but the Russians make other stands, like at Smolensk before, which is quite a dramatic battle. The entire city's in flames, the French are, and others are charging the walls. There's this famous event on the retreat, the Battle of the Berezina, where they're crossing the Berezina River under fire. There's no bridges. It's freezing. People are freezing in the water. Very dramatic crossing. Napoleon is almost trapped. But they didn't want to go that route. They wanted to actually, when they left Moscow, go on a different route. But there's a much lesser known battle called the Battle of Malo Yaroslavets, where they're forced by the Russians to go the route that they didn't want to go, to continue westwards. So all these little things, and at the beginning of the campaign, the Russian armies are split. And so Napoleon's forces are trying to catch one of them and crush it. And if they'd achieved that, there would be no rest of the campaign. They would have beaten the Russians within the first few weeks. And there's a critical battle at Mogilyov, which is today in Belarus, where that doesn't happen, right? They're not able to isolate this smaller Russian army and crush it. So it's so much more interesting than just the, you know, he marches in, gets cold, marches out, game over, right? General Winter is very overestimated in terms of the whole picture of the campaign. So yeah, there you go. That's the short version.
Okay. And I guess obviously you guys are going to expand way more into this, right?
Very much so. And what the Prussians do when they fight, even though they don't want to, and there's some kind of informal live and let live. A British fleet shows up off the coast of Latvia. Yeah. Well, the British are trying to help the Russians, right? Mm-hmm. And Napoleon forced the Russians to declare war on the British and to stop trading with them. And then the Russians said, hey, dude, like our economy depends on trading through the Baltic with Britain, screw you. And that's when Napoleon invades. So the Royal Navy is then in the Baltic trying to cut off French shipments of supplies to the east and to use their guns to support along the Baltic coast, because the Prussians and some French are marching up towards the Baltic to besiege Riga, which is an important naval base, and where the British are sending supplies to the Russians. The British send like 50,000 muskets or something to help the Russians, who are short of supplies, right?
Yeah.
Does that have an impact? Sorry, babes. Like, does that have like the British involvement in supporting the Russians there? Is that quite
I was just going to ask the same. How effective was it?
Is it decisive? Can you guys like... swear,
I don't know, but like, was it a worthwhile support, or you know, was it just simply, you know what, we're going to ally you a bit, and it didn't really make much of an impact in terms of the grander scheme of, you know, look at the scale of Russia, the scale of France's empire and stuff. Yeah, I mean, that comparison,
obviously, you know, the Russians were happy to have the assistance. There's also a British general, Wilson, who publishes a great memoir afterwards, who's there observing and advising the Russians and so forth. But I wouldn't say it's decisive, no. I mean, yes, they send weapons, they send supplies, they try to harass the French, but not particularly. I mean, the Russians kind of do this one mostly on their own.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah. So talking or keeping on the Russians then, and you kind of mentioned that this era could be considered the birth of Russian nationalism. And I think many, and I, you know, even admittedly within myself, I kind of would have thought, well, hang on, like 1917 and all, you know, the Bolshevik era traditionally, I think. So what would the argument be for this period being considered the birth of Russian nationalism?
Well, I guess in a way, this period is the birth of nationalism, period. Right? Mm. Tout court, as the French would say, because the French Revolution comes, and that's sort of the first real stage entrance of nationalism in its modern form, right, in history. But for Russia in particular, it's still very much an old school dynastic, you know, with elements of kind of feudalism, right? The population are serfs, most of them. They're owned, indirectly sort of owned by the nobility. And the nobility don't even speak Russian to each other. They speak French to each other. And like the army command is half German speakers, Baltic German minority, but also then foreigners, mostly from Prussia, who come and to make a career in Russia. So It's really, I was going to say behind Western Europe in terms of the development of nationalism, but that's not really the right word. It's in a different space in terms of national identity. Like, it hasn't developed in the same way. And then this war happens where all of Europe is invading Russia, and the war takes on a much more modern flavor that has a big impact on Russian national thinking. So it's not popular to be a Francophile anymore and to only speak French and put French culture up on a pedestal. The Tsar issues a big proclamation to everyone in the country saying, we have to protect our fatherland from invasion. Everyone should join. The peasants should join. They should feel Russian. And so this is something that hasn't really happened as much before, right? Calling on every level of this old school dynastic society to feel this belonging to a Russian nation. And it gets to be a more extreme war because of this. So the peasants are encouraged to like be partisans, just like in World War II, and attack supply columns of the French and the Europeans and so on. And then there are all sorts of terrible atrocities, which we will cover in a bit more detail in the series. And then it's made into a massive symbol in the 200 years that come after that, right? So in World War II, for example, there's a lot of propaganda use that's made. Well, hey, these Europeans, now it's the Germans leading them. Back then it was the French. They're invading us. And back then we whipped them, yeah. Right? When the Tsar called on us to all bond together for the Russian nation. So we're going to whip them again in World War II. So Leo Tolstoy, right? He writes War and Peace, one of the most influential works of Russian literature based on this conflict. There's tons of other literature, paintings, poems that are patriotic Russian stuff that every Russian kid for centuries afterwards has learned in school. And it's all based on this conflict, which is in Russian called the Patriotic War. And that's why then in World War II, they call it the Great Patriotic War in Russian. Oh. So it has a huge impact on this concept of nationalism and how it's then used in Russia afterwards and up until today, I would say too.
No, interesting.
I think definitely with the political context that we mentioned earlier, it's really, I don't know, you could probably see on my face over Zoom, like it's like I was putting together a mental puzzle there thinking, oh my gosh, yeah, that does make so much sense. And it's only when you go back and you look at a whole kind of 200-400 year scope that you realize that there's so many repeated tropes throughout history. And that's why why particular strands of nationalism pop up in different ways in different countries, if that makes sense.
Yes, and this is one of the reasons why we often in the Anglosphere, which all three of us are from, why we often look at it as, Britain versus France in the Napoleonic Wars. Yeah. Why? Because that is the politically useful narrative in the in Britain, essentially, after the Napoleonic Wars as well, right? So there's some big bad guy on the continent who wants to dominate it, and that's not a something that only happens once in the last few hundred years. And who stops that and preserves kind of the balance in the world and stuff? Britain, right? Yeah. And so that's another narrative that goes and develops in a similar way. So
one of my favorite phrases, there are no lessons from history. And it's just so true, isn't it? Because you just see time and time again, there's always some big bad guy on the continent that everyone's going to take up arms against. And, you know, kind of gives us plenty of material for the podcast, though. So.
I didn't say it. But hey, who's in Kiev today? On this day of recording, who's in Kiev today?
Well,
what, Boris?
Yeah. I mean, he goes
where the puns are. He's actually bothered. Right? Wow.
Let's plunk him in a blue helmet.
Do you know what? If Russia wanted to secretly kidnap him and keep him there, that's fine. Honestly, that's fine. Let it happen. I think we just let it all just slip under the carpet, to be honest at this point.
But before we get ourselves in trouble, I think we should move on.
Seriously.
So, Jesse, obviously you've done our fun round before. We've heard your favourite and least favourite figure in history. But just talking about this period, I guess we'll narrow it down to, in your documentary series, who was your favourite figure that you have researched within this documentary series?
Yeah, I like, full disclosure, you sent me these questions beforehand, right? So I thought about it.
You want me to say this, Jesse?
I thought about it. And I will say this. Look, I'm not a Napoleonicist, right? So this period, I know the basics, obviously, from my postgraduate degrees and blah, blah, blah. But it's been a real treasure trove of new discoveries for me. And I think here I'm going to go with a woman by the name of Nadezhda Durova. Ooh. And she was the daughter of a Russian army officer, and her mother had some mental health problems, so she was then out of the picture, and she was raised by her officer father's men in a military camp when she was growing up. And then she joins the army pretending to be a man. She's not the only one who's done this in history, of course. There are lots of other, I mean, Olivia, I know you've done some work with these kinds of women before. She pretends to be a man. She joins the cavalry, and she fights in the war against Napoleonic France in 1806-07. So most of the fighting is in Prussia, mm-hmm. and she's at the major battles. She saves a wounded man by giving him first aid on the battlefield under fire and stuff. The Tsar summons her to St. Petersburg, to the giant palace and stuff, decorates her personally. He knows she's a woman. He even gives her another pseudonym to use once her old one got found out. And then she continues in the army, and she's in this 1812 campaign defending Russia. At Borodino, she's wounded in the leg by a freaking cannonball and won't leave her post until her commanding officer orders her to.
Oh my
and
God.
Then she retires from the army in 1816 with the rank of captain. She couldn't really get promoted because, you know, she couldn't grow a beard or a mustache, which was kind of required for a senior Russian officer at the time. So that's going to put a crimp in your career plans if you're her. And then she publishes a memoir called, well, the English translation is Cavalry Maiden.
Oh.
So, gentlemen of military history and Napoleonic Twitter, the woman of your dreams died 200 years ago in Russia. Sorry about that, guys.
Sucks to be them, doesn't it?
Well, she sounds fucking cool, doesn't she?
That's insane.
The king knew about her being a woman. I'm not familiar with this at all. Was it? Did people quite often know that they were that there was a woman in the army, and they just were kind of let it slide? Or
To be quite honest, I don't know. Like,
I think it varies.
Hard question to answer, but that just surprised me.
I mean, Olivia would know better than me, actually, on that.
I think, well, when I've looked into this before, it varies, because I think there are some cases where women have managed to get away with their disguises and been able to get away with it for long periods of time, that they just get accepted into being as a man. So when they are discovered, it's normally like they're discharged, that's it, you're off, kind of thing. Yeah. Or they've either proven themselves so much that it's like, actually, do you know what? Crack on, kind of thing. Yeah. Cultural acceptance as well, and how women were perceived too, so yeah. It completely varies, but I think the Russians were different because we see that continuing theme throughout the First World War and in the Second World War, and how women were mobilized and used as well.
No,
I mean, in her case, she did transfer regiments quite frequently in order to, you know, not provoke suspicions. So she was with like some Lithuanian hussars for a while and then switched around. I did come up with against a story in our series about the Franco-Prussian War, where a French woman joined the irregular soldiers, the francs-tireurs, but she joined her local unit from her own town, and she writes this in her she's quoted in a book saying, "Yeah, I wanted to join another unit and pretend, but the army wouldn't let me, so I joined a unit from my hometown where, like, my cousins were in it and my father knew the guys in it. And so they weren't going to do anything untowards, because the usual kind of patriarchal protection systems applied to her then if the guys knew her and came from her town." So,
Oh, that's fascinating. We'll definitely have to find out more about that. Liv, you can give me a lesson on women in the army. So flip that around then. Who is your least favorite figure that you researched in this period?
Well, look, as a Canadian, I don't like being unkind, right? This is, kind of, this is not what we do. But I think from what I've read for this project, I might go with Jérôme, Napoleon's younger brother.
Okay.
Seems like kind of a dick in a way. So Napoleon makes him king of Westphalia, even though, of course, you know, what the hell does he know about Westphalia?
Yeah.
When the campaign begins, he's not considered like, you know, a top military thinker or whatever, but he gets command of a massive army group of several corps. He brings all his fancy stuff on campaign with him, massive baggage train. Napoleon actually kind of criticizes him for that. And I'm not a fan of, you know, showing off if you've got cash and stuff. I think it's in poor taste.
Yeah.
And then he advances really slowly. Then he can't catch the army he's supposed to catch. So Napoleon gets really pissed off and puts him under command of Marshal Davout without telling Jérôme. So Jérôme then has a bit of an ego freak out and he ups and leaves the army after about 6 weeks. He he just, no, after about 3 weeks, two, 3 weeks, he's just like, okay, guys, I'm going back to Westphalia. Ciao. And he just leaves his entire army group and goes
back. What a drama queen.
Exactly. And he married an American, which as English women, you know, is going to cause you problems if you're a European royal. So I'm going to go with Jerome. It's probably a bit unfair.
No, it sounds valid. Valid.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, no, fair enough.
Yeah, I love that question. It's always so different.
Yeah. If you were going to take three people from your docuseries on a road trip, who would you take with you? And where would you go as well?
Oh, good Lord. Okay, first things first. Who would I take with me? Obviously, Nadezhda, our cavalry officer, because, I mean, that's just too cool to not,
you know,
to not great. Bring her along.
Maybe, yeah.
Plus, she clearly knows first aid. So if anything happens, that's helpful. Very helpful. I think I would take the Tsar's sister, Catherine, because she was kind of like his confidant, and they exchanged letters quite a lot. And she kind of tells him really what's on her mind sometimes. Like at first in his campaign, he's with the army. And this screws up all the command decisions because everybody is lobbying him to do what they want, all the Russian generals, and they're not listening to the actual general who's supposed to be commanding the army because the Tsar is right there at the headquarters. And so Catherine writes to him, is like, look, dude, fucking leave the army. You're screwing it up. Like, you are screwing it up. Leave the army. You're supposed to be the head of state, not the head of the army. Go back to St. Petersburg and, like, I don't know, you know, politically mobilize the nation, which he then does.
Yeah.
So I figured if I'm on a road trip and I'm like, no, guys, it's fine. We'll just, we'll try this shortcut or whatever. Catherine's going to be kind of like, look, dude, we're all hungry. We got to go to the bathroom. Just stick to the Google Maps or whatever. And then finally, for gender balance reasons, I would definitely take a guy, I guess, for the third. And I'm torn because part of me wants to take any Bashkir Russian cavalryman. The Bashkirs were like, they're a minority ethnic group in the Russian Empire, like an Asiatic Muslim group of nomads. And they kind of, their cavalry was used as, you know, harassing kind of scouting border guards and stuff. And even in 1813, so the next year's campaign in Central Europe, which we're going to cover this fall, by the way, for season two, they're still using bows and arrows.
That seems a bit old school.
I mean, why not? Recycling.
Sure. Partially because the Russian authorities didn't want them to be fully armed with modern firearms because they had risen up against Russian rule in the late 1700s. So not that long before this campaign. Yeah. So the Russians are like, hey, you guys are useful. Go and scout for us and harass the enemies, but we don't want you to rise up against us again.
Can't be trusted with big guns.
So it would either be some random Bashkir dude or the French marshal who was in command of the old guard, Marshal Lefebvre. And I don't know that much about him, but one quote from him is enough for me to think that he's the kind of guy I would want to have on a road trip.
Basically,
in November, and fair warning to any of your listeners, and maybe your grandparents are listening or something, not safe for work language coming your way. So on this terrible retreat through the frozen wastes of Western Russia, when everybody's freezing and starving and the Russians are harassing them and firing on them, his men want to give up and he's driving them on and they have no strength left. And he basically, I'm going to read this out because it's so awesome. He gives them a kind of speech that kind of says, like, guys, come on, it's now or never, like, do it. He says, if you don't follow me, you're fucked. I am no ordinary general. And it's with good reason that in the army of the Moselle, I was known as the Eternal Father. Grenadiers and chasseurs, I say to you again, if you do not stay with me, you're fucked. And anyway, I don't care a fuck. You can all go and fuck yourselves. This is the guy's speech to his own men.
He emphasized it. He had big confidence, clearly. He backed himself.
Imagine backing yourself that much that you would stand in front of an army and just tell them all, you can go fuck yourselves if you don't follow me, because this is ridiculous. Oh, amazing. I love the idea. I would be like, fair, let's follow everyone.
He's seriously got it.
I'd do
with
it.
The two very clearly very strong feisty women you've also got in your car, and then him, that'd be quite the car journey.
Oh, I'd love to see road rage. That'd be brilliant.
It's gonna be massive. And of course, for as to where I'd go, I think there's no question we've got to go Moscow to the Pacific.
Nice.
Like, oh, that would be awesome.
Good distance. Yeah.
Yeah, that would be so amazing. Cool.
Oh, that extract's really tickled me. That's really good. That's perfect note to finish on, I think, Jesse. You've nailed that.
There you go.
This is why we invited you back.
The official documentary will not contain that density of swear words, let's put it that way. I'm not going to promise there won't be one somewhere in a quote, but
it's historical, you know. They'll say PG.
Just following what the sources say.
It's the history. We can't help that, you know. It's what history says.
It's not PG.
Okay, so Jesse, where can they find it? Give us all the details, etc. Please and thank you.
Right, Napoleon's Downfall, Season 1, The Russian Campaign 1812. They can find it starting February 24th. On YouTube, on the Real Time History YouTube channel. And of course, reality being what it is, we would very much appreciate anybody who's interested in this series and helping us to make it happen to support us financially on Patreon if they can. And for that, they can go to the Patreon website and search for Real Time History. It's going to be a blast, possibly with limited swearing as well.
Amazing. Yes. No, we'll post all of these links on our Twitter pages so that all of our listeners can find them, because I'm sure they'll want to watch it after listening to this.
well, thank you so much
for coming on. This has been a blast. So yeah, thank you so much for speaking to us.
It's been my pleasure. And the second time was as much fun as the first.
Oh, you're sweet. You can come back. And that was Jesse Alexander talking to us about his new documentary of real-time history, Napoleon's Downfall. In the meantime, don't forget to like, share, and tweet everything on Twitter. Check out any of our episodes as well, and we'll be back again with another episode next week. I've been Olivia Smith.
This is Phoebe Style, and this is Carl Kamilaki signing off.